Let me start off by saying this. So we've already laid down the foundation for critical thinking, right? We went through those two arduous studies on logic and syllogisms and all that kind of critical thinking. We've laid that foundation, which is awesome. We're going to need it moving forward. You'll see how it applies in a little bit. But this basically allows us to think properly, think critically, a little bit of skeptically, you know, some of the stuff you might hear on a day-to-day basis regarding religion, Christianity, God, Jesus, any of that kind of stuff. But now we can move forward and analyze crucial arguments. We get down to the nitty-gritty, right? So for and against the existence of God. Now, as I mentioned, there's several arguments. The ones that we'll be studying in the coming months, as I mentioned, one of them is the cosmological argument. We'll also study the moral argument. That's basically how do we know that there's a God through just the existence of objective moral truths? How can we argue for a God there? Another one is the design argument, or some people call it the fine-tuning argument. What is it? There's some things in the universe that look designed. You know, we can look to a car, we can look at a bike right there. We can automatically tell some things are designed. Does that apply to the universe? And can we argue for God's existence that way? And another one would be an argument for the existence of miracles. Now, this one's pretty cool. Obviously, a lot of people, you know, we maybe typically during our lifetime, we may not experience a miracle or be actually aware that we're experiencing a miracle. But is there evidence that miracles actually do happen even today? And if that happens, then obviously there's a God, just on the definition of a miracle. So we'll look at all those. These by far do not exhaust all of the arguments that are available today for the existence of God. But those are some of the crucial ones. Those are ones that pop up just on a regular conversation that you might have with one of the students down at UT. So I think these are a good start. Some of the good ones that we can look at. And we'll look at those in the coming months. But let's get started right away with the cosmological argument. You guys have your study guide. It's not really going to follow, you know, some of the way the questions are worded, they're not going to be, I'm not going to say them verbatim. So it's going to have to take a little bit of a, you know, read between the lines and listen between the lines, stuff like that. So let's get started right away. I'm going to ask you guys, have you ever been outside just on a typical day and you're looking at creation, or what we call creation, but you're just looking at nature and you've just asked yourself, wow, where did it all come from? Is there a creator to all this? I think I'm preaching to the choir here. I think all of us would say, yes, it was created and God was the creator, right? But you know, that answer, yes, it was created just like that offhand without anything to, you know, explain it. That might be a good argument for religious experience. But would that really convince somebody else, a skeptic, maybe even an ardent skeptic? So if you tell them, I mean, look at this bike, or look at the tree, you know, look at the stars. Do you think all this just came from nothing? You think it just is? There's no design. You know, I don't think a skeptic would really buy that answer. You know, if you just tell them straight out, this tree has a creator, nature has a creator, the universe has a creator. What do you think will be the next words out of their mouth if you ever tell them that? Do you have evidence? Prove it. Exactly. That will be the question, or the next sentence out of their mouth. Now, then the ball is in our court. Do we have good evidence to say the things we do about creation? Of course, some of us would readily point to the Bible. It's like, I believe the Bible is the word of God, blah, blah, blah. That could be another argument for the reliability of the scriptures and stuff like that. But is there something, another reason or reasons that we can point to or use to show that the universe is indeed created? And that's what we're going to talk about today. Now, before we get to the actual argument itself, I do want to mention every worldview. Now, for those of you who've come even from the first study, we studied about worldviews, all the different types of worldview. And we mentioned every worldview must have an explanation for these big questions. Where did we come from? Why are we here? And where are we going? Every worldview should have sufficient and greater explanatory power and explanatory scope for these types of questions. Otherwise, your worldview is silly, and it really doesn't have a lot of backing to it. So you shouldn't really hold a worldview that doesn't answer these questions satisfactorily. Now, so it's where do we come from, why are we here, and where are we going? And you can go back to listen to that study, and we'll give a list of the major worldviews that are in existence today, and you get to listen to what assumptions they're making. You can make that decision for yourself. But back to our question, where did all this come from, right? Even down to the atomic world, where did the atoms come from and stuff like that? Why are we here? Or if I can put it succinctly into this one question that has plagued philosophers, theologians, and pretty much any person who's ever lived on the planet in history, they've asked this question, why is there something rather than nothing? That is the fundamental question. Why is there something rather than nothing? And so we kind of sound like four-year-olds, right? Or grown-up four-year-olds. Why? But that's the big question. Why is there something rather than nothing? And speaking of worldviews needing an explanation to this great question, we're here in a church, we're all Christians here. Does Christianity offer such an explanation about the universe? I think we would all be nodding our heads right now. Oh, yeah, I think so. And it's easy to start. I'll give you some verses right here, and there's plenty more, believe me. But these, I think, are some really good core ones, and you can memorize these. Just like Bungie was asking you, tuck them away in your heart. Let's look at a few here. Genesis 1:1, obviously first page in the Bible. Well, first page after the table of contents and preface and all that. But Genesis 1:1 says, "In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth." So you have this notion that there was a beginning, and then you also see that God created. And then heavens and earth is a neat little phrase. And back in those ancient days when these verses were being written, there wasn't really a Hebrew word for the universe as we have it now. And the way they referred to it was the heavens, everything in the expanse up above us, and everything beyond that, and then the earth, everything here we can see and touch and all that. So that they're talking about, in the beginning, God created the universe. And then in the New Testament, the Gospel of John, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, John wrote, "In the beginning," again we see that, "was the Word," another word for Jesus, "and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through Him, and apart from Him, nothing came into being that has come into being." Basically, God created everything. And there's nothing that exists that wasn't created by God. He has His finger on everything. In Acts, chapter 17, this is one of the great sermons here. And Paul was telling the philosophers there in verses 24 and 28, "The God who made the world and all things in it, since He is Lord of heaven and earth," or the universe, and then skip over to 28, he says, "For in Him," in God, "we live, we move, and exist." So our being, our fundamental existence is owed to God. And then in Colossians, the Apostle Paul wrote in chapter 1, verses 16 and 17, "For by Him," by God, "all things were created, both in the heavens and on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or authorities, all things have been created through Him and for Him." So not only, in this one particularly, not only do we see that God actually did create everything, but that last phrase, "and for Him," there's a purpose behind it all. And lastly, we look at Romans. Paul's letter to the Romans, chapter 1, verses 18 through 20, Paul wrote, "The wrath of God is being revealed from heaven against all the godlessness and wickedness of the people, who suppress the truth by their wickedness, since what may be known about God is plain to them, because God has made it plain to them. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, His eternal power and His divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that people are without excuse. That's a very powerful one. I want to point out, so it not only asserts that God created the universe a finite time ago, we keep seeing this phrase, in the beginning. So it talks about a finite time ago. But he's also left us evidence. Paul is saying, you're without an excuse. Each of us in this room doesn't have an excuse to believe at the very least that there is a God. Because nature points to the existence of a God. His, what it said here, his invisible qualities, eternal power, and his divine attributes. And we'll talk about some of those a little later. So we're all without excuse. God has left us evidence. Of course, that leads to the question, what evidence is it? But clearly, Christianity has, from the outset, Genesis 1:1, from the very beginning, it's asserted that God has created the universe, or brought it into being, or he's caused the universe to come into existence. Now, what reasons do we have to believe such an assertion? We can't just go around telling people, look at what my Bible says. I don't believe your Bible. Oh, man. We have to have other good reasons, right? Now we can actually enter into our argument proper, the cosmological argument. Cosmological. Let's break that word down. Cosmos, logos. Two words. Does anybody want to let us know, what does cosmos mean? First part of that word. The world, the universe, exactly. So whenever we speak of the cosmos, we're talking about the universe, everything that exists. Now, how about logos? Word. Right, the word. Another word that's been used for that, think of what other word does it sound like, logos? Logic or rationality. So here, cosmological is speaking about the rationality of the universe. So when we speak of a cosmological argument, we're presenting an argument for the rationality of the universe. Remember, we asked the question, why is there something rather than nothing? So this cosmological argument is attempting to answer that question. Why is there a universe rather than nothing? Why does it exist at all? And it attempts to argue for the rationality of the universe, and the questions we have to ask ourselves are, does the cosmos stand alone, or does its existence depend on something outside of itself? Basically, does the universe have a cause? Now, there are several cosmological arguments, and they've gone throughout the centuries. We're talking about even from the early church period, so before the 1000 AD era, and then in the medieval times, you know, kind of 1000 and on, you had Thomas Aquinas, who introduced his five ways. He had five arguments from motion, from time itself, and so he was trying to argue, there's things that move, why do they move, and what is the source of their movement? And so he brought up his five ways. That was one version of the cosmological argument. And then you had Gottfried Leibniz, who's the inventor of calculus, no less. Very smart dude. He had his hand in everything. But he brought up this version of the cosmological argument. He basically argued that there are contingent things that exist. Contingent means that their existence depends on something else other than themselves. For instance, each of us in here, our existence depends on our parents. We would not exist had it not been for our parents. So we're contingent beings. We don't have to exist. We're not infinite beings. So that was one version of it. And then the one we're going to study tonight is called the Kalam cosmological argument. It was first introduced in the medieval times. And then it was actually an Islamic scholar who started arguing for it and trying to gain evidence, philosophical evidence, to show that this universe had a cause. And it kind of dropped off the radar for centuries. And it wasn't until the mid-1900s when a philosopher named William Lane Craig, he pretty much single-handedly brought it back into the scene, to the philosophical scene. And he's done great things. And we'll talk about what evidence he's brought up. But it's made a great comeback. And I think it's very powerful. It's very persuasive, at least to me. I hope it is to you guys. But that's the one we're going to concentrate on today, the Kalam cosmological argument. And this argument is going to argue for a temporal cause of the universe, so a beginning of the universe. It doesn't depend on the contingency argument or movement or something like that. It just says, does the universe have a cause? How do we know? So now we can look at, we can begin with some observations, and I hope these markers work here, and I hope you guys can see them. But these are some of the observations we want to begin with. This marker is horrible. That's not an observation. It's separate. All right. Our first observation is, I'll just use a capital U. Nope, that's not. I'll use a capital U. Wow, how do the kids learn in this class? There we go. Big U. The universe exists. I think nobody would argue with this. We would not deny this. The universe exists. That's our first observation. The universe either has a beginning or no beginning. So I'm going to put no big B here or B. It either began or it doesn't have a beginning. And out of these two, if it does have a beginning, this beginning was either caused or not caused. No cause. And then out of these two, if it was caused, then the cause of the universe is either personal or impersonal. Basically not personal. Hopefully everybody can see that. So let's look at it again. Universe exists. That's our fundamental observation. From there, and if you remember the logic class, whenever you're splitting up hypotheticals, thank you. Whenever you're splitting up hypotheticals, the easiest way to do it to exhaust all your options is either to have the option and then the negation of that, right? That exhausts all your possibilities. So, universe exists. Universe either has a beginning or it doesn't. If it does have a beginning, it is either caused or uncaused. If it does have a cause, that cause is either personal or impersonal. Okay, and we're going to argue ourselves all the way down to show that there is a personal cause. Hopefully it's persuasive, but that's where we're headed, okay? If you follow that little branch all the way down. Those are the observations we begin with, but now let's turn our attention to the actual argument itself, and it's in the form of a deductive syllogism. So while I'm writing this out, who can tell me or let the class know what are the strengths of a deductive syllogism? Why is it so worthwhile to have an argument in the form of a deductive syllogism?
For one, I can think of you can prove it from what you know already. I wasn't here in the first class, so I don't know.
That's fine, man. That's fine. Okay, well, let me write it out, and then you guys can actually see. You might get a hint here. Man, keep looking at the wrong one. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Has a cause. I don't know why I put a comma there. Let me erase it. Universe, I'll just put a big U, began to exist. Premise one, premise two, three. Our conclusion, therefore, What? Can anybody finish it? Universe has a cause. Big U has a cause. That is the deductive syllogism. Does anybody know what kind it falls into? It's a different kind of wording, but can anybody tell me what kind of syllogism that is? So I'm looking for maybe, is it a
categorical, it's the, I'll see if I cannot get loose in that way.
What are our three? Categorical, hypothetical, and disjunctive.
This would be hypothetical.
Hypothetical. What makes you say that?
Because it's...
Can you reword it? In such a way that it falls into that.
If something begins to exist, then it has a cause.
Mm-hmm.
The universe began to exist, therefore the universe has a cause.
There you go. So it is a hypothetical syllogism. It's in the form of if P, then Q. P, therefore Q. So this would be our P. Insert a little then in here, then it has a cause. That's our cue. And the way it's arguing is the modus ponens, the way of affirming. You affirm the antecedent. That was this part, right? You affirm P. Universe began to exist, therefore Q. Universe has a cause. Now, the great thing about such a syllogism is that the conclusion necessarily follows from your premises. That was one thing that we emphasized during the studies, is that that's the beauty of these guys, is that if these two premises are true, then the conclusion has to follow. It must. It's not like inductive reasoning, right, where you have a probability of something. You're arguing from specific cases and you're just trying to make a broad generalization. Deductive syllogisms argue from the general, everything begins to exist, has a cause, and you get down to the specific. And that gives you more certainty. So I think that's what one of the strengths of this kind of argument. If these two premises are true, your conclusion necessarily follows. Now, what's left to do here? What do we have to do then? Prove the premises are true. Awesome. So why don't we go ahead and do that then? And notice it's simple. It's elegant. You can memorize it very easily, even by the end of tonight. That's another strength of this argument. It's very elegant, simple, easy to memorize. And also, if we do successfully argue for this conclusion that universe has a cause, that actually serves to confirm the biblical notion of creation out of nothing. There was nothing, and then God created something completely out of nothing. We call that creation ex nihilo, out of nothing. So if it's successful, if we're successful in arguing this conclusion, we have the biblical doctrine of creation ex nihilo, which is awesome as well. But of course, we cannot simply make these assertions, as Chris pointed out. We have to argue that these premises are true. So let's look at the first premise here. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Now, in order to argue for this, I want to ask you guys a question. Can anybody give me an example of something coming into existence from nothing without a cause? Without a cause, that's the condition there. Have you ever, you know of anything, or have you ever heard or read of anything coming to existence without a cause? I see one head shaking over here. Oh man, I could come up with thousands. Come on, guys. I'm kidding. If I actually believe that, kick me out. You're right. I'm glad I didn't hear an answer. Otherwise, we'd have to talk. But really, guys, this is the beauty of this first premise, is that it's self-evident. It really needs no explanation. It is a self-evident truth that everything that begins to exist has a cause. And it's based on the fundamental intuitive principle that we all just kind of take for granted, that nothing can come from nothing. Or rather, something can't come from nothing. Nothing can't produce anything. I know these words that I'm using are, it's hard to conceptualize. From nothing, nothing comes. Nothing ever will. What do I have in my hand? Nothing. And I can wait all day long. I can wait for thousands of years. Nothing will ever appear. Nothing cannot create anything. So out of nothing, nothing comes. That's just a fundamental intuitive principle. So really to explain it, I think you would just have to ask a person that you're conversing with, well, give me an example of something that comes into existence without a cause. And I think both you and whoever you're conversing with would agree on this point, that therefore it needs no further clarification. But I do want to add this little caveat. In the recent years, there has been a push to actually kind of redefine nothing, such that people will say, but science is showing that things actually do pop into existence out of nothing. The next question that you should be asking is, define nothing. What do you mean by nothing? And usually it's not nothing. It's actually a quantum vacuum. So here's a good point where we have to have an understanding of what nothing is ourselves. And I know it just seems ridiculous to have to do this, but some of these words we just take for granted that we use on a daily basis, and it's good to have, you know, a basic definition. That way you can have a good grasp. So when you're approached by this question, what do we mean by nothing? Well, nothing is the lack of properties, attributes, characteristics. When we say nothing can come from nothing, and that nothing can cause nothing, I'm not actually saying that there's, you know, say this piece of, you know, this stick right here, this rod, and I'm calling it nothing. When I say nothing, I'm talking about the lack of everything. It has no properties. It does not have power to cause anything. So when I use the word nothing, I'm saying it lacks every property, every characteristic. I'm not pointing to something and calling it nothing. It's the lack of anything. Nothing is no thing. You might want to say it that way to the person you're conversing with. So therefore, if nothing is a lack of anything, any qualities, characteristics, any essence, then it lacks causal power. So when your friend or whoever is arguing that things can pop into existence out of nothing, and they say that nothing is actually a quantum vacuum, you can point out, well, quantum vacuum is not really nothing. And you might see the little light bulb turn on at that point, hopefully. But at least you have a good, solid definition of what you mean by nothing.
When they say quantum vacuum, they mean what, some vacuum where they say they've pumped out the air, so there's nothing in it.
They're talking about just this kind of this field of energy where there's positive and negative energy just kind of in existence. And because of certain laws of nature that are already there, then it's just a matter of time before we see, boop, stuff appear. But you see, you have the laws of nature, and you have positive and negative energy in there.
Forces,
exactly.
It's nothing.
Right.
I mean, it's not nothing.
Yeah, that example, something. That example is something.
Yeah.
But think about it this way, guys. When we say nothing, don't even imagine a black space, because that's something. It is the absolute absence of anything, okay? I got to hammer that home, because we really have to have this down, because this is a common question, or it's actually becoming a common argument these days. So you can actually use these examples. It, don't even think of a black space. It is absence of anything. Okay. It's hard to conceptualize. Right, exactly. Yep, good point. All right, let's move on from that because my brain's tired. So as I mentioned, this premise one is self-evident. I think it's obvious. It's intuitive. To actually have to figure out ways to explain it would be even harder than just say it's intuitive. So premise one, I think we have good grounds in saying it's probably true. It's true. We can agree with this first premise. Everything that begins to exist has a cause. Does anybody have any questions on that? Maybe you're a little skeptical. Maybe you need a little bit more explanation. All right. Well, let's move on to premise two. Premise two says the universe began to exist. So we're affirming the antecedent here. The universe began to exist. This is the crucial premise. This is the one that will require a little bit of head knowledge, a little bit of digging into, a little bit of researching, a little bit of thinking. But let's do this. Now, before we even get to the argument and providing evidence for it, we have to ask the question, what do we mean by the universe? Remember, guys, language matters. We have to clearly define our terms, especially with the person we're communicating with, because more than likely, they're coming from a different background. They're coming from a different set of, an entirely different set of assumptions. And so when we say universe, in their head may pop up different ideas from what you're thinking about, what you mean by the universe. So we have to clearly define our terms. And it would be helpful, maybe, you know, when you're sharing the second premise, that you just go ahead and explicitly let them know, this is what I mean by universe. So let's talk about this for a little bit. What I mean by universe is all of time, space, and matter. We typically say that we live in a 3D world, right? So my body has mass. It extends out into space, you know, more than I would like it to, but there it is. So if you're taking a basic math course, you know, and you're drawing your little graphs and stuff, you typically have the x-axis and the y-axis. And you have a z-axis, which is kind of the little 3D dimension to it, right? Maybe you guys have seen a 3D movie recently. So typically movies back in the day were 2D. So you had just a screen. It was flat. And the way they drew the pictures made it seem like there was depth to it. That depth is the third dimension. That's that z-axis that we're talking about. So typically we've thought, you know, we live in a 3D world. Well, you know, back in Einstein's time, you know, they discovered that time itself is actually a dimension, that it's relative. You know, you have Einstein's theory of relativity and stuff. It showed that time is actually relative, so it added a dimension. So now we can say that the universe consists of not only matter, you know, mass here, or the stuff we're made of, the stuff that the universe is made of, and then space, which is everything in between the matter, and then also time itself. And that's kind of a hard concept to visualize or think about, but just know that when we talk about the universe, we're talking about space, matter, and then time as well. Now we can, are there any questions to that? Okay, feel free to raise your hand. So now we can answer the question, was there a beginning to the universe? Can we actually give solid evidence to show that the universe began to exist? And we're going to consider two types of evidence. The two types are philosophical. We're going to consider philosophical evidence to show that the universe actually did have a beginning. And then we're going to turn around and we're going to show some scientific evidence. And that's very popular these days, to provide a scientific answer to those who are asking questions. But remember that little kind of tree that we drew in the beginning? We're in the part that said the universe either had a beginning or it didn't have a beginning. That was the first branch there. So we're going to argue for the universe having a beginning. Well, let's start with the philosophical evidence. Don't let the word philosophical throw you off or scare you or anything. These are good concepts. They're very easy to understand, I believe. And if they're not, you know, let's take our time and walk through it. That way we can all understand it. But think about this. If the universe did not begin to exist, so just imagine with me, if the universe did not begin to exist, this is the equivalent to saying that prior to the present event, right now, now, prior to the present event in the past, there existed an actual infinite number of past events. If there's no beginning, right? Then in the past, there was an actual infinite number of past events. So going back to math class again, right? You had your timeline here. You know, and it went either way. But back, you usually had the negative numbers, right? But imagine this is a timeline, literally, of time. Now, usually you had little tick marks here to represent, you know, certain places where you are on the number line. And, you know, this is maybe how you learn to count. You know, you start here. What's 1 plus 3? And then you moved up 3 spaces, whatever. But let's let this represent the present time. If there is no beginning, then this line has no end. It literally has no end. It just keeps going on and on and on and on and on. And it is an actual infinite number of past events. There is no beginning. Now notice that I kept emphasizing the phrase actual infinite. Because there's two terms that we have to have a good grasp on, and that those two terms are actual infinity and potential infinity. And this should be on your study guide. So it's the difference between actual and potential infinite or infinity. When we say potential infinity or potential infinite amount of things, we mean a collection which is increasing towards infinity, but it never actually reaches infinity. So think about if you just started today counting upwards from 0. 1, 2, 3, 4, as fast as you could, and you just never stopped. And you did this for 10,000 years, say. And you're at the number, you know, 400 quadrillion zillion, whatever. You're way up there. That's still not infinity. And guess what? If you had the curse of living forever and you just kept on counting and counting, do you think, when would you reach infinity? You never would, because there's always a number that you could actually count to. So that's a potential infinity. You're increasing towards infinity because it's always past whatever number you're at currently, but you're never actually reaching infinity. So that's potentially. It's a collection which is increasing towards infinity, but it never actually reaches it. Now, when we talk about actual infinite amount of things, this is a collection in which the numbers of the members within that collection is actually infinite. So think of say I have a collection of numbers that are all the real numbers. So from 0 and on. And my collection of numbers is actually infinite. It's a complete set. All the numbers you could ever think of that actually exist are in my actually infinite set. It's not a potential. I'm saying that they are all actually in my collection. That is an actual infinite amount of things. So this is crucial, guys, because I'm not saying that I might have all the numbers, you know, and I can actually add more numbers in. I'm saying, no, they're all there, that I have an actual collection. And let's actually flesh this out with an example to show the difference and the absurdities that would result if we actually believed that actual infinites actually existed. All right, and there's a famous illustration from a famous mathematician. It's called Hilbert's Hotel. So this is to show that when we deal with actual infinities, that if they were to actually exist in reality, they would result in absurdities. So this is trying to show that actual infinites do not exist in the real world. Sure, we can deal with them on paper. You know, when we're doing math equations, we can use a little sideways 8 or whatever, and we can plug it in, and, you know, it would make sense on paper. But when we actually, when we transfer that over to real life, all of a sudden, the real world would just look crazy. It would look stupid. And so this is what this illustration is going to show. Let's look at Hilbert's Hotel. First, I want you to imagine a hotel with a finite number of rooms. pick any of the hotels here. They usually have, you know, hundreds of rooms. 304. Let's say that. 304 rooms. That's a finite number. I can count up to 304, and it has a beginning point, it has an ending point. That's finite. And let's say they are all occupied. What would the hotel manager, what would the owner there tell you when you try to reserve a room?
No vacancy.
No vacancy, right? You would, in fact, hopefully you would see the sign on the out, that neon sign saying, no vacancy. Sorry, you can't come in here. We're all full. That's the typical experience. That makes sense. We experience that on a day-to-day basis. But now I want you to imagine a hotel with an actual infinite number of rooms. Remember, it's a complete set, so it actually has infinite number of rooms. And that all of these rooms are occupied. One person comes in and requests a room. The owner says, sure. And he simply moves everyone over one room onto infinity. So whoever was in room one, he tells them, hey, pack your bags, I want you to move into room two. Guy in room two, I want you to move into room three. So on and so, all the way down to infinity. And guess what? You know, new guest comes in with his luggage and goes into room one. And all of a sudden, you're still full. But what happened? The hotel was already full, and they just added one more to infinity. That's the same thing as saying infinity plus one equals
infinity.
Infinity plus one equals infinity. That's interesting. But that's legal. That's a valid move when you're talking about actual infinities. Now, suppose some guests begin to check out. Now, let's say guest number one checked out. Is there one less? Let's put it in this form. Infinity minus one is?
Infinity.
Infinity. But infinity plus one also equals infinity. What's up with that? Well, how about this? What if all the guests in all of the odd-numbered rooms checked out? Okay, so 1, 3, 5, 7, all the way down to infinity. All the odd-numbered rooms checked out. How many guests would you still have in the hotel?
Infinity.
So infinity minus infinity is infinity. It's weird, right? Well, remember, all of the odd-numbered rooms is an actual infinite, right? You have an infinite number of odd-numbered rooms. So infinity minus infinity equals infinity. What?
Then there's still infinity.
Yes. That's what I'm trying to show. This is an absurd notion.
Infinity divided by two.
No.
But it's still infinity. That's what I mean.
Yes. Yeah. But that's not what this particular one's showing, right?
Yeah.
All of the odd-numbered rooms, it's an infinite set. All the odd real numbers. And then how about this one? Now, what if all guests above room 3 checked out? So 4, 5, 6, blah, blah, blah. All those, all the way to infinity. What if all those guys checked out? How many rooms would be taken now?
Still infinity, because you can never reach that.
Well, it's all the rooms above 3.
So you got
3 rooms that are taken. So all the people 4, 5, and 6 checked out. So that's an infinite number of rooms, people that checked out 4, 5, 6, blah, all the way to infinity. So infinity minus infinity now can also equal 3. This is weird. And so this is what I'm talking about is when you're dealing with actual infinites, if this were translated into the real world, all these types of absurdities would occur. And so at the very least, you couldn't operate a hotel business because, you know, you'd always be in the red. This would be ridiculous. Wait, which infinity am I talking about? I'm just going to put infinity minus infinity equals infinity. I'm always making money. So let me just ask, could such a hotel exist in reality? Of course not. So that's one piece of philosophical evidence. Therefore, we can reason then from the impossibility of the existence of an actual infinite, that if the universe did not have a beginning, then there would be an infinite number of past events, but since an actual infinite number of things cannot exist, therefore there cannot be an actual infinite number of past events for the universe. Therefore, the universe had a beginning. I'm going to stop there a little bit. Do you guys have any questions? Is there something that I might have just worded wrong? You guys need a little bit more fleshing out of?
Can you write that out?
Which part?
The whole
thing. No.
I'll send you my notes.
What you just said, therefore.
Okay, so yeah, that you could put that in a little syllogistic form. It would be the... I forget the form of it. I probably have it on my browser, but it would be, if the universe did not begin to exist, then the number of past events is actually infinite. An actual infinite number of things cannot exist.
Yeah.
Therefore, the universe did not have an actual infinite number of past events, which is equivalent to say the universe had a beginning point. I can write that out after. It would just take me forever to write it because I have ugly and slow handwriting, as you've seen here. But
okay, I'll ask you.
I'll show it to you. It's in one of the tabs I have open. Okay. But yes, you can put that in actual syllogistic form, and you can say, let's walk through this. That's the beauty of putting things in syllogisms, guys. That's why we went through that. But yes, if you agree with those two, it necessarily follows the universe had a beginning. And this is philosophical reasoning. And I wanted to say this when we were done, but I'll go ahead and throw it now, is that the beauty that we have actual philosophical evidence to show that the universe had a beginning is that, you know, when we get into the scientific portion next, you know, science conclusions are changing on a daily basis. And even if you have really strong evidence for a long time, long period of time for a specific conclusion, you can't be certain about that conclusion, because evidence brought up the next day can wipe it out just like that. But this does not depend on scientific data or conclusions. It's philosophical knowledge. We argued for it, talking about actual infinites, we argued for it deductively. And so it doesn't matter what's happening in the scientific realm. Even if the arguments that we're going to present next for science fail, it doesn't mean that the universe didn't have a beginning. It just shows that science, that particular science evidence that we had failed, but we still have the philosophical evidence. That's another reason why this the evidence that we're showing for the second premise is a strength for this argument. So we have two types, right? Philosophical, scientific. That's why I wanted to bring up the philosophical first, so we can, you know, grab the strength of it and memorize it. Now, there's one more piece of philosophical evidence. We're not going to touch on it today, but it shows the impossibility of counting to actual infinity. Remember I mentioned, what if you started counting from zero? You'll never actually count to infinity. So that means you can't count to positive infinity, but that also means that you can't count down from infinity. So because we have a present moment, that means we actually counted to a point, an end point here. Therefore, there had to be a beginning. Otherwise, we would never have gotten to the present moment.
Just would have just appeared right now.
We would, let's talk about this. Yeah, we would never have reached, because you would have to have counted an infinite number of points. And you can never cross that boundary. You can never cross that realm. But like I said, we won't go through how that works. I can put it, you know, in the newsletter. You know, maybe you can look up evidence and arguments for that on your own for homework. But if you want, you can contact me and we'll go through it. It's pretty fun stuff, talking about potential and actual infinites. But now, let's move on to our second line of reasoning, which is the scientific evidence. There's two kinds of evidence, or two pieces of evidence that I'm going to show here. The first one is the expansion of the universe. And this has to deal with cosmology, astrophysics, stuff like that. And don't worry, you don't have to know astrophysics or be an astronomer, stuff like that. Just know that there is a scientific consensus, and you can actually point to that. That's not an appeal to authority, by the way. when we're pointing to this consent, you're not saying it's true just because they say there's actually good reasons to believe, but we're kind of condensing it and saying, look, here's the evidence and you can trust it. But again, you know, don't take my word, you know, don't take me at face value. I'm sharing with you, but if you have any questions, of course, just go do the research on your own. That's what we want to encourage here with this class, is to promote critical thinking, as Chris Knox was talking about earlier. You always got to try to discern what you're reading, what you're studying, stuff like that. But let's consider the first piece of evidence here, scientifically, which is the expansion of the universe. Now, up until the late 1920s, so this is very recent, okay, in terms of history in the universe. Up until the late 1920s, the universe was thought to be static. It was just thought to, like, it just existed. It wasn't moving. It wasn't really changing. It wasn't growing, for sure. And it wasn't shrinking. It was just static. But in 1929, Edwin Hubble, the guy who the Hubble telescope is named after, so he that telescope takes awesome pictures of the universe far, far away. So this, he was an astronomer, and he was looking into his telescope, you know, throughout this period in the late 1920s, and he discovered, when he was looking at distant galaxies, and he was trying to measure what type of light or energy they were giving off, and he noticed that it was more into the red spectrum. So a quick brief here is that light is spread out into this vast spectrum. So when we talk about, there's different frequencies, right? The light that we're seeing right now, the different colors, like green shirt, green sweater, the white stripes, black here, these are all different types of frequencies that we're observing of light. And it's visible light. So there's a portion of the light spectrum that is visible to the human eye. Dogs and different animals, they see different parts of the light spectrum. Okay? And when they're looking through the telescope, they can actually have a filter that will look at different spectrums of light, and just to see what kind of energy they're giving off. And so Edwin Hubble noticed that these galaxies that were very, very far away, he noticed the further he looked, that they were more into the red. And that meant that they were actually moving away from us. So we have Earth here in our Milky Way galaxy. These galaxies were actually being moved further out from us. It's like they hated us or something. They just, I don't want anything to do with you. So they were going more into the red. And a good way to think about this is, it's called the Doppler effect. Is that, you guys have heard an ambulance siren. You know, you hear it from way out there. Or maybe you hear your dog howling and something. And you're like, oh, that's an ambulance or a cop car or something. But you start hearing the siren, and it's at a maybe a low register. So it's like, and then when it gets closer, it starts sounding like an actual ambulance. You start hearing the actual sound, but you can tell the pitch of that siren changes. So it goes, and then when it, right in front of you, as it leaves, like, like that. That's called the Doppler effect, is that the sound waves, as they move closer to you, they are happening at a higher frequency, so more towards the blue. But then when they move away, it's more towards the sound waves expand. So that's more towards, think of it in light terms, it's more towards the red. So that's what's happening with these distant galaxies, is that they're moving further and further away from us, and they're actually moving further and further away from us at a faster rate. Okay, and he noticed that. But remember, the assumption up until that time was that the universe was static. It certainly wasn't expanding. But he noticed this, and he said, why are these galaxies moving away? What's going on? And that's what came to be known as the expansion of the universe. It wasn't just that these galaxies were moving away. It's the fact that space is actually coming into being at that moment. So the more expansion that happens to the universe, the more space is being created. Think about it this way. You have a balloon, and maybe you glue some buttons, you know, on it. And when you blow up that balloon, when it gets wider and wider, you see those buttons separating from each other. And then the space in between, think of it as the universe. That's what's happening. It's expanding in all directions, and space is just inhabiting those empty spaces, right? So space is actually coming into existence, so as it keeps expanding. It wasn't that they were just moving. And so this came to be known as the expansion of the universe. But what are the implications of this? Well, if it's expanding, couldn't have always been expanding. So let's say you kind of stepped out of the universe and you witnessed this. It's expanding. Well, let me go ahead and press the rewind button on my VCR. And it's what would happen? What would you see?
Condensing.
It would be condensing, right? It would be contracting all the way down. I mean, it would take forever, but it would come all the way down to this point where matter, time, and space were being condensed into this point, this infinite dense point, which is the equivalent. I remember I just used the word infinite, but that's the way scientists talk about it. But what this means, and you'll hear their implications, they say that the universe actually came from nothing. This is very interesting. And at first, scientists didn't want to agree with this conclusion that the universe is expanding, because they knew if the universe is expanding now, that means it's expanding from beginning point. It had to have a beginning, because if you just press rewind on the time of the universe, it would go all the way back to this infinitely dense point where all of time, matter, and space were contained into that one point. But it's the equivalent of saying it came from nothing. Remember having those old CRT televisions? Whenever you would turn it off, and then you'll see a bright flash, and then it goes down into that little white point. It's like that, and then all of a sudden it just goes away. That's what the universe is. That's the equivalent of the contracting of the universe. If we press the rewind button, it came from nothing. So that's one piece of evidence here. So then we can say the universe is not eternal in the past. The atheist historically has always said this about the universe. Because obviously you have Christianity at least saying God created the heavens and the earth in the beginning. But the atheist has always said, well, there's no God. Therefore, the universe is the one that always existed from eternity past. But now we have scientific evidence, good, solid scientific evidence showing it had to go back to a point of nothing. And this is very troubling for atheists. And they come up with certain ways to reason around it. And we'll talk about some of those objections later. But that's the first piece of evidence, expansion of the universe. The next one is the second law of thermodynamics. And maybe for some of you high schoolers, you might be beginning to delve into these topics. Second law of thermodynamics, it states that the processes in a closed system tend to a state of equilibrium. So think about it this way, where you have a glass bottle and you shake it up. Say you have some Coke in there. You shake it up and there's a cap on it. What would you see happening in that bottle? If it's a bottle of like Coca-Cola or something, if it's carbonated, it would start fizzing, right? You'll see that it start going crazy. It's like, and then you see the bubbles kind of separating from the liquid and stuff. But then after a while, all that activity kind of just settles down, and then you're back to just having a nice, calm bottle of Coca-Cola there. But that's an example of the second law of thermodynamics in action. Is where everything, all the processes in the closed system, they tend to go into a state of equilibrium where it's just at rest. Now you also have the first law of thermodynamics, which says that energy, which is what we were talking about, all that action, that's just energy, potential energy being stored up. But the first law says that you can neither create nor destroy energy in a closed system. So there's a finite amount of energy in the universe, basically. So these are laws that govern the universe. And the first law of thermodynamics says you can either create it or destroy it. There's a finite amount, and that's just what you're left with. Do with it what you want, but you can't insert more. It's a closed system, the universe I'm talking about. But then you couple it with the second law, and it says that, well, all this energy is actually being used up. Think about it, right? The galaxies are moving further and further away. our planets are revolving around the sun. This is all energy that's being used up. There's a lot of movement. There's a lot of chaos going on in the universe, and that's using up this finite amount of energy.
So what was the second law of thermodynamics?
It says that all processes tend to go into a state of equilibrium, you know, after a certain amount of time.
In a closed
system, obviously.
All
yeah. And so you think of like shaking up a Coke can, and after a while, you know, it stops fizzing.
Is that the same thing as entropy?
No. Yes, that is the law of entropy is always increasing.
Which is the third law, right?
I thought it was the second, actually. Is where
entropy only increases?
Because that when entropy increases, that means that all the energy, all the chaos will soon become turn into equilibrium. So that energy is being used up. That means that entropy is always increasing. So things go from ordered to chaos, but it will enter into a state of equilibrium. I thought, second law, I mean, I thought it was talking about entropy. Entropy is always increasing. Yeah. Wait, is it second or third? Okay, second. So yes, the key word of the day is entropy, where you're always having, you're always seeing chaos. You'll never see something becoming ordered out of chaos. Right.
Humpty Dumpty falling off the wall
again. You have all this order. It's not going to stay in order. It's just going to...
Sooner or later, he's falling off that wall.
Right. There's chaos is always going to occur in a closed system. So, but after a certain amount of time, all that energy is going to be used up. So the first law says we have a finite amount of it. Second law says you're using it up right now. And so if we put these two together, it's only a matter of time before, guess what? Oh, you're out of energy. And I had an illustration here. Think of a car and you filled up the gas tank and you start driving down Highway 1. And let's say Highway 1 extends out however long. Now, you have a finite amount of energy, which is your gas, and you're using it. You're pressing on the gas pedal. You're using up that usable amount of energy. But think about this. If your car had been running for an infinite amount of time, as the atheist has said about the universe, that it has actually existed from eternity past, so there's an actual infinite of past events, that's what the atheist says, would you still have gas right now?
No.
No. If you have an infinite amount of time and you've been running your car for an infinite amount of time, why would you still have gas at the present moment? You've had an infinite amount of time to use it up. Surely, and you only have a finite amount of it, you would have used it up infinite amount of time ago. So you wouldn't have gas right now. But obviously we see that the universe is still here. The universe exists. We're still here. There's still order to the universe, energy that we're still using up. So therefore, we can point and conclude that the universe is finite. The universe does not extend into eternity past. There's still energy. As long as there's still energy, we can point there's a finite amount of it. There's a finite beginning to the universe. So that's kind of a coupling between the second law and the first law of thermodynamics. Any questions about that? So remember, guys, these are pieces of scientific evidence. Science, the consensus is always changing. Scientists have different assumptions about the way they interpret data. So there may be some scientists that are obviously Christian that are in agreement with the conclusions that are being drawn. But then there's atheistic scientists that will be like, well, let's keep looking, you know. I don't like the conclusion that says it has a beginning, so let's keep looking. But those are different assumptions. But remember, we can always fall back onto our philosophical evidence. Now, with these pieces of evidence in place, I think we have a good case. So we have the philosophical and the scientific. I think we have a good case to show that our second premise here is true. And I hope you guys find that persuasive as well. If not, you know, let's raise some hands. Let's get a discussion going. But now our conclusion says, given the truth of premises 1 and 2, because of the nature of the syllogism, it logically follows, it necessarily follows that therefore the universe has a cause. The universe has a cause. The universe has a beginning. Therefore, everything that begins to exist has a cause. Now, as a Christian, you're like, right on, right? But let's see if we can take this a little further. Sure, the universe has a cause. But that cause could be anything. It could be a stack of magazines. We could say anything about this cause. But let's look a little bit harder at what implications there were drawn that we can draw from these arguments that we just made. So let's try to discern the nature of the cause of the universe. All right. One of the first characteristics that we can conclude about the cause of the universe is that it's uncaused. Right?
It would have to always exist. Yeah, I mean, whatever, because otherwise that in turn would have to have a cause. And
you would have an infinite string of cause and effects. But
it wouldn't be infinite, so it wouldn't have the power to create anything, so just like we don't. I mean, create the universe.
Yep.
So there had to be something outside of it.
Yep.
Chris, and
I'm going to take a break. Chris can take over. But that's the first characteristic we can draw, is that it's uncaused. Because we know that there cannot be an infinite regress of causes and effects. You can't just say, well, the universe always was. That means there's just an infinite string of cause and effects. That's what we experience, right? Causes and effects. But that can't extend out into infinity. At some point, it has to stop. There has to be an uncaused cause that brought the universe into being. There has to be. So that's the first characteristic, uncaused. The next couple of characteristics we can conclude is that this cause is changeless and timeless. Because it actually brought time into existence. Remember, the universe is time, matter, and space. So if this cause created time, matter, and space, it has to exist outside of time or without time. So this, and then you, in order to change means you need time. Changes take time. You can ask my wife, she takes 20 minutes to change. I'm kidding, that was a bad one. But this cause of the universe is changeless and timeless. Another characteristic that we can draw from it is that this cause is immaterial. Remember, the universe contains time, matter, and space. So if matter and space were brought into existence, this cause has no matter. It doesn't take up space. So it's immaterial. Now this leads us, so far we have uncaused, changeless, timeless, immaterial. And then another one would be, this cause has to be extremely powerful. Remember, we're talking about a cause that can bring into existence out of nothing. It can create using no elements that exist already. So I think to create something out of nothing, that would at the very least be extremely powerful, if not omnipotent, all-powerful. And this leads us to our last dilemma. Remember the little branches. The universe either had a beginning or no beginning. We showed that it had a beginning. The universe, therefore, either has a cause or no cause. We showed, logically, that the universe has a cause. Now we're at our last dilemma. If the universe has a cause, this cause is either personal or impersonal. Now, why do we say that? Well, let's consider an impersonal cause. In causes and effects, whenever you have all the necessary and sufficient conditions for an effect to happen, whenever that cause is in place, the effect has to be there. For instance, when I throw a rock at a window and the window is has certain properties, maybe it's weak enough such that, you know, the slightest pebble can hit it and it'll break. So let's say I throw the slightest pebble. The moment that rock hits the window, all the sufficient conditions are there for the effect to happen, which is, ta-da, a broken window. So whenever you have all the sufficient conditions, the effect has to take place. Now, if you have an impersonal cause, then we already know that this cause is infinite itself. It exists without time. It is the uncaused cause. So if this cause has always existed, but it's impersonal, then that means that the universe should have to have existed alongside it for eternity, or for an infinite amount, as long as the cause is in existence. That would mean that the universe is eternal in the past. I know that's kind of hard to wrap your head around, and I know I didn't explain it, you know, the best, but let's just say if it's impersonal, as soon as you have the cause, you must have the effect. So if this cause is impersonal, the universe would be eternal. But maybe it might make more sense to talk about a personal cause, because the only way to have an eternal cause bring about a temporal effect would seem to be if the cause was a personal agent. Think about it. You know, you guys are sitting down, and at a certain time, hopefully soon, you guys will decide to stand up. You're making a decision, a personal decision. You're a personal agent, and you decide to stand up. Now, if you were an impersonal cause, you could have been standing up from eternity past, and the effect would have always been alongside the cause. But you are a personal agent. You can decide to bring about different causes or different effects at different times. That means you have the freedom of the will to bring about certain effects. And so I think, since we showed that the universe actually has a beginning point, it didn't always exist. The only way that we can have this alongside an eternal cause is that the cause is also personal. It is a personal agent that has freedom of the will. Does that make sense, guys? Anybody have a question about that? So, let's list the properties again. We have an uncaused cause. This cause is changeless, timeless. This cause is also immaterial. It is also, at the very least, extremely powerful. But now we've also argued that this cause is personal. Now, what does this cause sound like to you? Sounds a lot like God, right? And historically, that has been the definition of God. God has always existed. He's never not existed. He's powerful, all powerful, but certainly powerful enough to bring something out of nothing. Changeless, timeless, immaterial. God is spirit. These are all characteristics that describe God. And so I would venture to say that the cause of the universe is God. There could be a fourth premise there. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Fourth premise, the cause of the universe is God. And so those are just implications brought about by philosophical evidence, by scientific evidence. So I think we have a good argument here, guys. Very elegant, very short, easy to memorize. And I hope it's persuasive to you guys.